Station number 14128, Frederick Parham, Reel 2.
The other sort of thinking of the odd items that occurred during 2 years I was in the ship. I remember a splendid occasion when the Swedish, a Swedish squadron visited Rosyth, and we, a certain number of officers in the war fight, were invited to dinner in their flagship called the Drottning Victoria. And that I remember, we sat down and we hadn't been progressed very far with the dinner, when the commander of the Swedish ship got to his feet and said, "Gentlemen, in Sweden we have a custom to welcome our guests." And then he turned to his compatriots and said something, 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 I don't know what. And they suddenly burst into a tremendous song and then drained their glasses. And we thought, well, we must do something about this. And the senior officer of our party, who was a commander in the Barum, which is our flagship, leapt to his feet and turning to us said, "Gentlemen, John Brown's body." So we all started on "John Brown's body, John Brown," you know. However, it seemed to go all right. And the other thing I remember about that occasion was we had the most frightfully nice dental officer on board called Sammy, for short. He'd just got engaged, and for some unknown reason, he celebrated his engagement by going TT. But of course, on this particular evening, he couldn't possibly remain TT. And after the dinner was over, we all went on board the Queen Elizabeth, the Free Flagship, to a concert. And on the way across, I remember old Sammy turning to one of the Swedish officers and saying, "Juno, you chaps talk English so jolly well that honestly I don't know whether you're English or Swiss." And so that was laughed off. And then we came alongside the Queen Elizabeth, and old Sammy, thrusting everybody aside, was the first up the gangway when he was met by the Commander-in-Chief, Admiral Sir John de Robeck. And he sprang smartly to attention, saluted, and said, "Good evening, sir. We've just come on board with a lot of Swedes." Well, then we had various other cruises to Barcelona, where I remember losing my heart to a gorgeous creature with red hair who came from Cuba and was known as the Cuban Queen. And then finally, the sacred flame of gunnery was lit in my heart, and I decided to specialize in gunnery. The long gunnery course consisted of 9 months at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, followed by 9 months in HMS Exton, the gunnery school at Whale Island, Portsmouth. There were 14 of us altogether in the course, and it was pretty hard work, and ended up with 3 solid weeks of exams, at the end of which we were fairly teased out. And I remember that on the last day, we had a dance at Whale Island, and I remember our instructor officer saying to us, "Well, now look, you chaps have been through a pretty good strain. Now, for goodness sake, beware of reaction. I mean, say, don't go rushing off to get married or something ridiculous like that." Anyway, 1 week later, I was engaged. After a short time on the instructional staff with 2 others of my course, I went back to Greenwich for 6 months advanced gunnery course, all highly theoretical and so on. And after that, I went back to Whale Island, where I was the junior officer in the experimental department. I was married during that time on the 18th of August 1926 in Christchurch, Bath. I was then told that I was going as second gunnery officer of the Nelson, a battleship which was just completing, or getting towards the end of completion, of building at Newcastle, and discovered to my horror that there was an excellent little tiger of a captain of this ship called Matthew Best, who had been captain of the Excellence, who had very, very strong views about young officers getting married. Not that I was as young as all that, but I wasn't very old. And I went joined the ship with some trepidation with a wife in train. But however, he couldn't have been nicer, as a matter of fact. We went up to Newcastle, my wife and I, and were given 24 hours in which to find rooms in which to live. And it was a very weary business going from place to place, and we eventually picked up some lodgings in Jesmond in Newcastle, which were pretty grim, but the landlady, who always wore her hair in curlers, certainly all day and I suppose all night, couldn't have been nicer. And eventually I remember warmly kissed my wife when we eventually left. We didn't know it at the time when we booked the rooms, but there was another officer in the same house who was a very confirmed bachelor and rather shy, and also a great stickler for etiquette. He used to take me down in his car to the shipyard in the mornings, and he was very punctilious, as I say, and was always saying, I must come and call on you, because it was never the right time. We never got back until about 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the evening, and during weekends he was busy fishing. But one day when we were sitting together in our sitting room in a couple of armchairs, which were the sort that made you sort of start to scratch after you sat in them for a bit, and in came the little maid of all work with an enormous missive from this chap to say, may I pay this long promised call? So we said yes. Asked the maid to say yes, rather, do come. And we pulled up another of these nasty armchairs to the fire. I of course was still in my rig, and I'd come back from the shipyard, which was pretty rubbly, plain clothes. And his bedroom was immediately over the top of our sitting room, and we heard walking backwards and forwards and drawers being opened and closed, and thought, good Lord, he's lost his nerve. But anyway, after about nearly half an hour, I should think, there was a discreet tap at the door, and in he came, immaculate in a dinner jacket. We looked rather horrified, and so did he. And then he explained to us what had happened, that the maid had gone back with our message, and he'd said to her, are they dressed? She blushed to the roots of her hair and said, oh yes, of course. Well, that ought, of course, to have made the evening, but it didn't. Things got more and more awkward, and eventually he left. Well, there's nothing very much else to tell you about what went on in Newcastle, doing the final completion of the building of this great ship, and more and more officers arriving as time drew nearer for us to commission. And I do remember vividly our final departure from the shipyard at Walker-on-Tyne. This was the first battleship which had been built for the Royal Navy since the war, so it was a very great occasion. And the wharf was absolutely packed with workmen. And we eventually shoved off and sounded our great sirens, and it was a very elevating moment, really. But from the wharf there was absolute dead silence, not a chirr, nothing at all. The answer being, of course, that every one of those men, the day we left, was going to become unemployed, which was very rife at the time. But after a comparatively short time as second gunnery officer in Nelson, I had another appointment, and I went as gunnery officer of a smallish cruiser, also in the Atlantic fleet, called the Canterbury. Nothing but very particular to say about that, except we had two thrilling Baltic cruises, and with the first squadron, we and our three sister ships, passed through the Kiel Canal as a squadron. I remember that quite well, because most of the way the people on the banks just waved and shouted cheerful greetings and that sort of thing. But in two places girls' schools had been assembled, and under the direction of their headmistress with great venom sang at us, Deutschland über alles. It was while I was in the Canterbury, actually while we were at a place called Tallinn, which was then the captain of the capital of Estonia, that my son was born. I remember that evening we had a dance on board, and one of my partners asked me if I was married, and I said yes. And she said, and have you got any children? And I said, yes, one son. And she said, oh, really? And how old is he? So I looked at my watch and said, I think about 8 hours. Then, by extraordinary good fortune, we visited officially Guernsey, where my son had been born. And so I saw him there for the first time. At the end of that cruise, we went back to Chatham, which is our home port, to give leave. And one afternoon, the engineer officer took my wife and myself out for a motor ride. He was one of these chaps of whom people say marvelous driver, by which they really mean he takes appalling risks, but then he gets away with them. Anyway, coming out of the dockyard gate at about the widest point of road in the whole of Chatham, we had an appalling collision with another car, which hit us broadside on, and tipped the car over. My wife and I, it was a little Morris, my wife and I were sitting in what's called the dickey. She fortunately was on the inside, so was merely rolled onto the pavement. But I on the outside described a parabola or whatever it was, and met the dockyard wall with my head and fractured my skull. So off I went to hospital, and of course had to be relieved from that job because I was going to be sick for too long. I wasn't very, very long in hospital, as a matter of fact. I think it was about 6 weeks. And at the end of it all, they gave me 4 weeks sick leave, which I thought was not frightfully generous. But anyway, after that, I was appointed as one of the two lieutenant commanders in the experimental department again, in the excellent. Then, of course, came the problem of where were we going to live. We very, very nearly got a most charming little house in the village called Sunnig, up on the top of the Portstown Hill, or the other side of the Portstown Hill, but just missed it, and so were forced into a flat in Southsea. And I remember I used to go up to work at Wade Island every morning by tram, arriving, I may say, in time for breakfast. That was a normal procedure, which reminds me of years later, the wife of a friend of mine who had just retired, saying, you know, it's all very fine, but I mean, I married him, I thought, for better, for worse, but never for lunch. Well, at the end of, I think it was nearly 2.5 years I had in that job, and in 1932, I was appointed as gunnery officer of the Nelson, which was an absolutely plum job. She was fleet flagship of the Home Fleet. The Commander-in-Chief, when I first went there, being Admiral Sir John Kelly, a very, very well-known character. He was completely unorthodox, and he was a huge man and extremely ugly. But there was a good story told about him. He was going off to his cabin one day, and the marine sentry outside his cabin had got a bit tired and was leaning up against the bulkhead and had gone to sleep. And old Joe came along. Any normal admiral, I suppose, would have said, what the hell do you think you're doing? Why don't you stand your attention at once, or something like that. But not Joe. Joe very, very quietly approached the sentry, also leant up against the bulkhead himself, just alongside him, and then nudged him in the ribs and said, it's all right, mate, I got the weight. He was relieved, Joe Kelly, by Lord Cork, an entirely different character, whom I loved also, utterly different character, tiny little man, always wore an eyeglass screwed into his eye, which made him look particularly fierce, and he had bright red hair. And he shook us up all right, and the whole fleet for that matter. I remember the there was always an annual inspection of every ship, and in our case, of course, we were inspected by the Commander-in-Chief, Lord Cork. I remember one of the days when we'd been doing all sorts of evolutions and getting all the boats out and all the Carly floats, the life-saving things out and so on, and the whole ship was in absolute turmoil. And then it was dinner time, or lunch time, and we all heard a sigh of relief, as we thought. But just as we were all going into lunch, a messenger ran up to the captain with a chit from the admiral to say, there's an insurrection ashore, land the whole of your landing parties once, or rather have them fallen in for landing, and I will come and inspect them. Well, the landing parties were part of the gunnery officer's job. So anyway, we got however many it was, and of course the Royal Marines, and he inspected the whole lot. And I remember one awful incident when he came to a funny little party at the end of one of the companies of men armed with rifles, and they called themselves the medical party, and in charge of them was a fairly young sick berth attendant, and he was carrying what looked like a sort of enlarged schoolboy's satchel, and Lord Cork screwed his eyeglass into his eye and said, "What's that?" And the man said, "Medical valise, sir," and then committed the absolutely unpardonable crime of giving gratuitous information and said, only to be opened by the orders of a medical officer, sir." "Oh yes," said the admiral. "And is there a medical officer in this landing party?" "No, sir." Well, the only other sad incident there was when we took the ground, which was when we were leaving past the Portsmouth Harbour. The ship didn't answer our helm properly and ran up on the Hamilton Bank, which was a really rather degrading experience, with of course the whole of South Sea front lined with goofers. But anyway, we got her off by the grace of God and got her back, and she was practically undamaged. And we went out incidentally then for a cruise to the West Indies. At about this time, that's the middle of 1934, promotion for me to commander appeared to be possible. Promotion was all done by selection, when you were within a certain zone of seniority as lieutenant commander, and it looked possible and hopeful that I might be promoted on the 30th of June. And just before that, I was on deck watching a regatta, as a matter of fact, and a seagull flew overhead and let fly at me. And what it let fly landed exactly on the peak of my cap. And as you know, probably, the peak of a commander's cap has gold oak leaves on it. So I remember writing to my wife and telling her about this and saying I hoped it was a good omen. Anyway, on the 30th of June I was promoted. We were at the time somewhere in Northern Ireland. And I had a mass, of course, of signals and telegrams and letters and goodness knows what. And a telegram from my wife which merely said, "Good old seagull." Well, having been promoted, of course, I left the ship and went to the Admiralty in the Gunnery Division of the Naval Staff. That again meant another move, and we cruised round and found a really charming little Tudor house in Westrum in Kent. It was a tremendous thrill that the first house, as opposed to flat or lodgings that we'd ever lived in since we were married. And what's more, we were able to afford a car. It was a Morris 8, actually, but we were terribly proud of it. I may say that in those days there was no such thing as marriage allowance, though finance was pretty tight. Well, that was an interesting job. It coincided with the tremendous argument that went on with the Royal Air Force about bombs versus battleships. The Royal Air Force claiming they'd sink any battleship that ever came in sight, and the Royal Navy, of course, saying the opposite thing. However, it was interesting, although, of course, entirely office work. And after 2 years of that, I was appointed to command a small destroyer called the Shikari. She was specially fitted out to control an old, old battleship called the Centurion, which had been stripped of all her armament and so on, and acted as a target for the fleet to fire at. I mean, a real target instead of just the thing that was towed. They didn't, of course, fire explosive shells, and the size of guns they fired at it was limited to 6-inch. All the same, of course, they made a fair good mess of her, and it was nothing for the officers to go back and find that a brick had arrived in their cabin. From my point of view, it was extremely interesting. It was a wonderful experience in ship handling, because what we had to do was, when the Centurion would go to sea, followed by us, and then just before the firing was due to start, we had to go alongside the Centurion while she was steaming at about 10 knots or something like that, and take off the whole of the crew. We then got within a respectful distance of her and controlled her movements by wireless. And then when all the firing was over, then we again went back. It was really quite an eerie experience, that really, bringing the ship alongside a great battleship which had nobody on board at all. And her crew leapt on board as soon as they could and rushed down and got her into a normal condition in which the engines were controlled in the normal way. Particularly at night, it was almost eerie, but as I say, a really very good experience. I wasn't very long there, and then I was appointed as captain, as a commander, of the Gurkha, one of 16 new tribal class destroyers building. She was building up on the Clyde, and again, my wife looked for somewhere to live, and we found a very charming little hotel head of the Gerloch. We had very strong tie with the Gurkha Brigade, and a wonderful old man called, oh, I've forgotten his name now, General, I don't know, it doesn't matter, presented us with some very beautiful trophies, including the inevitable cookeries, and also a very lovely little bronze model of the Gurkha Brigade's war memorial in Nepal. We were to join the Mediterranean fleet, and we sailed, I remember, from Devonport, I think exactly 1 week before Christmas. The Spanish Civil War was going on at the time. I remember having a little trouble on the way out, wondering what I should do when I saw a large Spanish cruiser menacing a couple of our merchant ships. However, that blew over all right. We eventually arrived in Malta, and I had my first thrilling experience of taking the ship stern first down Sleema Creek, which was crowded with destroyers. I mean, so tightly were we packed in there that when a destroyer was coming in, all the others used to get their lower booms in, as the things that stick out from the side of the ship to which the boats are attached. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been room for the ship to get past. Well, on Good Friday in 1939, as you may remember, Mussolini invaded Albania, and the whole of the Mediterranean fleet was ordered out of Malta to go to Alexandria in Egypt. And the edict went forth that all the wives who were out in Malta had to do one of two things. Either they could go home, or they would get assisted passages to go and join their husbands in Alexandria. So my wife telegraphed to me to say, which shall I do? And I said, go home, and she came to Alexandria. where we had a jolly good time, in fact, although it was semi-war routine the whole time. We thought that the war was liable to happen at any minute. I mean, I think there was much more, we were much tauter and worked up about that than they were even at home at that time. But anyway, we enjoyed ourselves with plenty of work to do. And eventually, the division to which I belonged, as the Free League Gurkha, Sikh and Mohawk, paid a short visit to Athens. My wife came over from Malta to join us, and we took a room in a hotel. And the first evening, I couldn't get ashore, I think because I was suffering from what was called a jippy tummy. Anyway, my tummy was upset. But I got ashore the second evening. It was very, very, very hot, midsummer. And my wife and I went up to have dinner up in the hills, and deliberately went to bed very late because it was so hot. And we were sleeping in single beds, and my wife had been there, as I said, the night before, and had a very good night. But soon after I got into my bed, I started to sort of itch a bit, and so I put the light on and said, "Because something awful's happening here. I don't know what it is, but something's biting me." And my wife said, "Nonsense, it's your imagination. Put the light out." So I did, and then it got worse and worse, and so I put the light on again, turned the sheet back, and I don't want to be disgusting, but I've never seen anything so loathsome in my life. The whole of the bed was crawling with bed bugs. So we rang the bell and a waiter came. This was about 2 o'clock in the morning. His only language besides Greek was French. I was speechless, but my wife said to this chap, "Regardez mon mari, il est mangé." And the chap shot out the room, this is absolutely true, came back 5 minutes later with a plate of sandwiches. And the next day we swept out of the hotel and went to the one next door. After that, Kathy went home by boat to Marseille and then overland, and got a home just in time before the war broke out. Meanwhile, we had moved to our war station, which was the Red Sea, and we were there for some little time, not long, because it very soon became evident that Italy was not going to join in the war, and so we were brought back to the Mediterranean and spent a little time escorting French troop convoys to the east, and also in contraband control, which we stopped any merchant ships coming along and searched them to see if they hadn't looked as if they might have any contraband on board, and then sent them into Malta to their extreme annoyance, where they were searched. Well, that went on, I don't remember exactly, only a few weeks, and we were ordered back to the North Sea, which is a fairly ugly shock from the bomb of the Mediterranean, and we did almost incessant times at sea, until eventually, just before Christmas, we stripped our turbans, and so we had to go into dock at Southampton, where we were for Christmas, and my wife and my son were able to join me. And on New Year's Eve, 1939, I was promoted to captain. On promotion to captain, I went back to the Admiralty, only this time at one of the parts of the Admiralty which had moved to Bath. I was what was called Deputy Director of Naval Ordnance. And as I said, we went to Bath, which, of course, is my native city. And there we found a charming little Queen Anne house up on one of the hills overlooking Bath. And it was a very busy time, and my wife was equally busy running canteens and things. We lived happily in this house, which was a bit crowded. It was just about right for my wife and my son and myself, but on top of us arrived my in-laws, who had just got out of Guernsey in time before the Germans got in. So the house was extremely crowded until the bombing of Bath. You remember that there was a period when the Germans went for all their sort of cities like Bath and York and Exeter and so on. I forget what the raids were called. They were deliberately, no military value, but just horror and terror. We weren't hit, but we were rather knocked about, and life was difficult, and there wasn't any gas, and there wasn't any water, and so on. And so we persuaded our in-laws, or my in-laws, to move somewhere else.